All right, let's continue. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. This is a graphic to show the scales of interest that we're talking about here. One of the things I want to point out on this scale is that there's a large distribution of kelp beds up in this area and very little in the Estero Bay area where the discharge is, and then kelp beds continue down here. And the reason I want to point that out is kelp beds are a nursery area. They offer protection for otters. They're a favored habitat for otters. They offer protection from both the inclement weather conditions, sea states. They protect them from predators, sharks. They don't get that protection down in the Estero Bay area because it's essentially an open, sandy coastline. And so this is not a preferred habitat for otters in this area. I wanted to show you where in Estero Bay the discharge is on a bigger scale than what Matt had, I think. This is about 12 miles of coastline. And what's of interest here is all the otter census, a lot of the toxoplasma analysis of the otters, and demographics and strandings are done by coastline sections. Well, the entire Estero Bay is considered one coastline section. So when the analysis is done for otters, whatever it may be, it's typically considered as a whole. And as you can see, it's relatively devoid of kelp, and the location of the outfall is in a very exposed area where it's open ocean conditions coming in, and because of that high turbulence that results, there's a greater dilution that's realized as soon as the discharge occurs.
I'm not sure what point you were trying to make with that.
You mean the otter part of it?
Well, all this about where the kelp bed is and the fact that the census point is the entire bay.
Well, I was trying to show the scale of the discharge. I'll get to the scale of the discharge in the next slide, but a lot of the discussion in the past has been about otter strandings,
right,
and otter toxoplasmosis. Well, those analyses are done on the entire 12-kilometer-long area. So the quote-unquote hot spot is not a spot, it's an entire region of 12 miles long.
Well, are all of the census, is that the same then for all the census points?
No, actually the coastline, if you look back here, there's another census, and these vary year to year, but in most recent years there's another a coastline section for census that extends from San Simeon down to Point Cayucas. And then another, and then there's one in Estero Bay, and then there's another one to the south.
So you're saying that the census points are not equal in terms of the amount of acreage?
Well, more the point is these are very large areas that they're summarizing, and very large relative to the discharge we're talking about.
Okay.
And I also wanted to point out that this is a different habitat, so we'll see later how different the census numbers are in this region and some of the reasons why that is.
Okay.
Okay, so I was looking closer at the outfall, and this is a different point I was making here, is that it's open ocean conditions, and this helps in the dilution and dispersion of the effluent. If you look closer, and this is the graphic that Matt showed earlier with the stations and how extensive the monitoring program is, we monitor actually the effluent before it's even discharged with a scan of 167 different chemicals. These benthic stations are the reference stations. They're considered far too far from the outfall to be influenced by any of the discharge. This was in the original design of the program, and it's been confirmed in subsequent analysis. And Matt showed you a different realization. This is a different water quality survey where we towed the CTD instrument a little deeper. And what I've shown here is the calculated dilutions based on the salinity. In the green area, at about 300-fold dilution, that means there's 300 parts seawater to one part wastewater, you begin to lose any capability to detect it's so dilute, the wastewater, that you can't detect many of the properties you normally think you would be able to see, such as suspended solids, dissolved oxygen, that kind of thing. The only thing that we're seeing at that kind of area in the green is the salinity signature. And we can trace that out to about 1,000 to 1, a little less than 1,000 to 1. But at that point, all traces of the discharge wastewater has disappeared, despite the use of these incredibly sensitive probes and instruments. And it's interesting to note that this is about a 50-foot zone of initial dilution, and that's about 50 times smaller than the distance to shore. So there's really a large buffer distance between the shoreline and an even larger distance from the entrance to the bay.
Question I have for you on that slide, and if you wouldn't mind, I'm going to stop the clock while I get into this. You've read the 85 FDA study?
Yes.
The dye study?
Yes.
So how do you reconcile that dilution that you're depicting with the fact that in that study they did trace fecal coliform bacteria up into the bay on an incoming tide? I know that we have disinfection now. We didn't then. But in terms of dilution, how is it that if that model is correct, in 85 they did find bacteria in measurable quantities getting up into the shellfish beds?
They didn't. And in fact, your own regional staff, I believe, Roger, you were co-author on that abatement order that reviewed the distribution and reviewed, in fact, that FDA study. In fact, I might have a graphic on it, if you bear with me.
Well, I do remember reading the study 20 years ago.
Right, but it's been discredited since then. The dye that they were detecting was really background concentrations.
In the bay itself?
Yes. Let me just bear with me a minute here. I'll try and find it.
While you're looking for that, it seemed to me that even if we gave credit for those dye concentrations being real, which were they down in the 2 parts per billion range or something like that, that we calculated this incredibly large dilution beyond what Dr. Coates was showing on the screen there. I think it was something like 16,000 to 1 that you would have if those fluorescein dye concentrations were real and not some artifact from kelp or some other background.
Well, I'm having a little trouble pulling it up.
Excuse me, Chairman. I have this statement from the FDA study, if you want me to clarify this.
Do you want to put it up on the screen? Do you have it scanned?
It's a 1983 document. I'll just read it. It's 2 sentences.
Okay.
Staff's analysis indicates the FDA reports data support the assumption of typical bacterial decay rates. FDA reports city plume concentrations of about 0.3 part per billion dye, not fecal coliform or coliform, at stations 113, 114, and 110. I'm sorry, I don't know exactly where those are. In summary, it says this indicates a physical dilution of 16,700 parts seawater for every part effluent.
That's pretty close.
And as we've, you know, pointed out later, the actual detection limit we've since learned for dye is higher than 0.3. It's like around 0.5 because of, as you explained it, efflorescence of naturally occurring phytoplankton. Is that correct?
That's correct. The instruments that we use for tracking dye, and we have some experience with this, have been around for a long time, and they've been using lakes and rivers. But when you get into the ocean, especially this part of the coastline, there's a high primary productivity, which is plankton, phytoplankton are generated. And these very same instrumentation that are used to detect the fluorescence of the dye with a very slight change in the filter, they're the exact same instruments that they use to evaluate primary production to map the plankton distribution. And so they are sensitive. The plankton themselves produce a fluorescence that is detected by these instrumentations. So when you go back and you're looking at dye, you reach a level where you're at background concentrations. And what's even more interesting is the plankton are very patchy too, so you can be easily fooled in thinking that, oh my gosh, I'm tracking a patch of dye, when in fact you're tracking some plankton. And these are very low levels. We're talking about subparts per trillion concentrations. They're way down there.
But didn't they track the plume itself?
No, they really didn't.
Some drogues or something?
Well, they deployed drogues, and it was more for tracking the general direction of the flow at the time that they were doing the study.
But that's what one would do. Right?
Yeah, but the drogues didn't go anywhere near the harbor entrance.
The report that Matt is reading, is that staff's analysis of the FDA study?
That sounds like what you're referencing.
That's correct.
Okay. Is there an FDA report with the data?
All we have is a staff report summarizing the FDA report, I believe.
Mr. Beckman, is there an FDA report that you've seen?
Yes, I think it's part of the record.
Okay. All right. And that's a separate document from what Mr. Thompson is referring to.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Let's continue. Thank you.
So this is the second topic I wanted to cover, is why we use infauna, these are the sediment dwellers, to establish a balanced indigenous population. This is really the gold standard that's presented by EPA to evaluate these ocean outfalls. You know, it seems kind of strange to think that you're going to use these tiny little creatures that live in the sediment to evaluate. Why would you do that? Well, partly because they are small and densely populated. You can collect a whole lot of them, and in the 2 decades of monitoring, we've collected 142,000 of them and identified what they were. And anyone of you that's familiar with statistics knows that the more sample points you have, the more power you have to detect change. So that's why they're used, is you can get a lot of them. The other attribute is that they're extremely diverse. There, as you can see, there's three completely different types of infauna shown here, and they exhibit completely different responses to pollutants. Some infauna are very tolerant of organic loading from an outfall, and they actually thrive on it and are opportunistic when an outfall deposits organics, they increase in population. Others are very sensitive. The filter feeders are particularly sensitive to it, and they disappear. So their diversity in response to pollution is an important attribute in detecting change, because you can compare, say, sites, the population at a site that's very close to the outfall with the population at a great distance or a reference site, and see how those populations change in terms of their feeding strategies. And they, as I mentioned, they have a predictable response to pollutant exposure. Over the many years, scientists have evaluated each one of these infauna, and by groupings, they know which ones are pretty tolerant to pollutants and which aren't. And an important aspect is that they can't really escape pollution. They're kind of tiny, and they're stuck where they are. They're not very mobile. As opposed to something like monitoring fish or something more mobile, it's kind of hard to tell where, if you have an impaired organism, it's kind of hard to tell where the fish really actually encountered the pollution, because it's moving around so much. These guys are stuck where they are, so you have a kind of a fixed pattern. And finally, they represent the middlemen, are actually the low part of the food chain. So they feed on detritus that falls out of the water column, but they're also fed on by fish and other things. So they kind of are an early indicator of problems in the entire environment. And with respect to their feeding strategies, that's one of the parameters we look at. And this is 20 years of data on the what we call the infantile trophic index. It's really a ratio between the number of healthy filter feeders in your samples compared to the organic deposit feeders. And up in this region is considered indicative based on all the other studies that have been done. This is indicative of clean sediments because there's a large proportion of filter feeders. These individual dots are the actual stations. The red dots represent stations that are very close to the outfall. The black ones are those benthic reference stations that I pointed out earlier. And you can see uniformly throughout the 20 years, they've all been at a high level indicating healthy, clean sediments. Moreover, if there were impaired conditions, you would see a slow separation of the red from the black, with the red moving down, the ones near the outfall moving down into an impaired condition, and the blacks probably staying the same. But that's not what you see. Over 20 years, they zigzag up and down, but pretty much they stay all the same. And this isn't the only community parameter we look at. We look at a variety, the density, the number of species, the diversity. And these are pretty diagnostic indexes of potential pollution. And again, we look for a separation in these lines through statistical analysis. We also analyze the chemistry in the same way. When we collect a sediment sample and enumerate the organisms and identify them, we also analyze part of that sample for the chemistry, and we look for separation again. If you had, a lead problem around the outfall, you would start to see the red stations increase in concentration relative to the black. But over the 20 years of study, we haven't seen that. I wanted to talk also a little bit about the population increase, or the otter population. In general, this is the total populations, and from about 1914, when there was a raft of small southern otters off of Big Sur, it's increased to about 2,700 otters today. And this is not only a total population increase, but also reflects an expansion in their range. So it's not as though this is a density or anything, but they now extend from
extend from San Mateo County south to almost Goleta. They're found in Santa Barbara County south of Point Conception now.
That's the most recent data we have. And so you can see that there are some areas that they have declined in population here, some fits and starts on their way to recovery. And, the overall recovery for the southern otter population hasn't been as rapid as anticipated. In other areas, the recovery has been much quicker. So there are some issues with the otter populations as a whole. To assess recovery and to look at the long-term populations, the USGS recommends looking at a three-year average, and that's what this timeline is here. So some of these small dips are probably not real, maybe just associated with differences in the ability to see the otters on a particular year when they were doing the census. And what's interesting is a lot of discussion has been in the recovery plan for otters, but that plan was produced in 2002, based on data in 2002, which was immediately after a decline and a leveling off. The recovery plan didn't address this recent uptick in the otter population. What the recovery plan did present is what they considered a threshold where the otter might be delisted as a threatened species. And that's about 3,090 otters, and we're at 2,700 now. So I think it's safe to say with these fits and starts, they are on their road to recovery. Let's look in Estero Bay in particular on otter populations. And again, this is the census I was referring to, and this is that one narrow area. And you can see that it's in the past 6 years, it's oscillated wildly. And there's reasons for that. One is that particular section of the coastline, when they do the census, they do it from aircraft. The other parts, or many of the other parts, they can do from the shoreline, which is more reliable. The aircraft, it depends on weather and things like that. But the other real reason that they vary so much is the population in Estero Base consists largely of transient males. They're not resident to Estero Bay. And you can see that the estimated carrying capacity of Estero Bay is about 89 otters, and this fluctuates quite substantially about that. The carrying capacity is considered what a resident population based on the food availability and availability of protection would support. Well, sometimes we have a lot more otters than supposedly it can support, and a lot of time, and on occasion we have populations of less than 50 in one census in 2002 that are far below what it could support. And the point here is when you look at the adjacent areas, this is the San Simeon de Cayucas, that's that kelp area to the north. It's a much more favored habitat for otters, and it supports an overall larger population. Similarly, the hazards to Pismo section does as well. The other thing to note, say the hazards to Pismo, is it's pretty stable in their populations, except for this one incident. And that's a huge population increase, and it was documented as a raft of transient otters that just happened to be in the area when they moving through the area when they did their census. So that's a reflection of this transient otter population, and it's in fact what's going on with Estero Bay here as well. The other thing to note is on the top of these is the pup population relative to the overall population of otters. And you can see that in these kelp areas, they are pupping areas because there's a significant portion of the population when they enumerated them were identified as pups. In the Estero Bay area, there's very few pups. And in fact, 2002, there were zero pups counted, and the same in 2005. So again, this tells us that the otters that are in the Estero Bay area are probably transient, the majority of them, and not resident to the bay. And that's confirmed in a recent, this is a recent, I think, 2006 study by the MMS, conducted a put transceivers on otters at two locations, and they looked what happened, where they went. This is a Point Conception group that they tagged and a San Simeon group that they tagged. So the red are San Simeon, and the others are Point Conception. And then they tracked them 4 to 7 times a week over a long period of time, many months. You can see what happened to the Point Conception otters. They traveled all over the place, and they even ended up in Santa Cruz. Similarly, the San Simeon spread out. Some of them ended up Santa Cruz. But what's interesting to note is a lot of the trackings, they move through Estero Bay in both directions. So that tends to support this idea that the otter population is transient, it's moving around a lot, and it's just noteworthy that the transceiver data supports that.
Well, let me just ask the question. Does that mean it's just coincidental that there's a lot of otters picked up in that area that have succumbed to Toxoplasma? I mean, how do you reconcile that information with what you just said?
Or
the point you were trying to make.
Okay.
I mean, that would suggest that...
Okay, here's the plot that's been shown. Okay, again, the area... These stars are just a study site. Okay. The real area that Pat Conrad is showing here as a high toxo area extends from Los Osos all the way up to San Simeon. So first of all, that's a broad region. And I think the implication, the hypothesis at this point, because nobody knows, is that the freshwater runoff from areas like Morro Bay and Elkhorn Slough are a source of the toxo Plasma gondii oocysts. Those are the originators that come from the cat feces. They're the ones that we can't detect. This is getting back to your other question. They're the ones that are tough to detect, the originators of the pollution. Once they get into a host, such as a mussel, or if it's on shore, a rat or something like that, then you can easily detect it in their muscle tissue, in their brain tissue. So once they're out of the environment and in an organism, you can detect them. But the real challenge here has been, where are the oocysts coming from? We know they're showing up in otters over a broad region here and here, but we don't know exactly where they're coming from. And the, like I say, the hypothesis is it's these large freshwater runoff areas, but until they develop a method to detect the oocysts themselves, we will never find out.
Okay. I think I didn't make my question clear, so I apologize for that. Your comment was that the Morro Bay area appears to be some transition zone where otters are both moving up the coast and down the coast?
No, my point is that...
Where they can be found in high numbers in that area? And there isn't there a permanent population of otters?
Oh, I'm sure there is. Probably located more in the Morro Bay estuary itself. But the habitat is not conducive to permanent residence. All I'm suggesting here is that these otters, because they move so widely, could have acquired their toxoplasma...
Anywhere else?
Anywhere.
Okay.
That's the point. So, and just to summarize, the reasons we don't see any evidence of impacts is the very low discharge volume, high effluent quality, and rapid dilution in an open ocean environment. We use evaluation of balanced indigenous populations from high-resolution benthic studies. And finally, the otter demography suggests that the otters are on a long-term population increase with fits and starts in between. And the Estero Bay otters are mostly transient, and they aren't residents, most of them, in the Estero Bay area.
Okay, thank you. You guys have 27 minutes still.
I believe we're done at this point.
Okay. Thank you. Let's see. That's Discharger's presentation. NRDC's cross-examination of Discharger's witnesses. Mr. Beckman?
Mr. Chairman, we don't have any questions.
Okay. And then we would then go to NRDC's presentation. Okay. Well, we're not going to take a break where we're going to get up to do that, but we'll wait a couple of minutes. 1 minute, okay. Okay. We're ready?
Thanks.
Yeah. Another speaker card? Okay. Mr. Beckman?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Director Strauss, members of the Water Board, Executive Officer Briggs, and Staff Counsel Oaken, thank you for the opportunity to present our perspective on the issue before you today. I'm David Beckman with NRDC. Anjali Jaiswal is here with me. She's going to do most of the presentation. I wanted to give you a broad sense of where we're going with our presentation and what we hope you'd take from it and how you'd integrate it with what you've heard so far today and what you hopefully have read in the record. There's a lot of detail. There's a lot of technical information, and if I were you, I'd be wondering, how do you sort that out? Well, there's a couple things we'd like to suggest about how to sort it out. The first is to think about, because you're the decision makers, you're the judges here, who has the burden of proof? Who has to convince you that the evidence supports their position? And here, nobody disagrees that that is the discharger. It is not the environmental groups. It is not up to us to show you today that it is absolutely certain that this discharge is causing otter sickness or anything else. And the reason that's the case is because 301H waivers are rare exceptions to the fundamental precepts of the Clean Water Act, the very basic standards. That's why there's only a few dozen in the country and less than a handful in California, as you know. A 301H waiver is an exceptional circumstance, and there has to be a very high level of proof before it's appropriate to issue. Our presentation is entitled, in part, Time is of the Essence, and you would think from the presentation so far today that it wouldn't matter whether this upgrade is accomplished in 5 years or in 8 or in 15. Well, that, from our perspective, is simply untrue. And from our perspective, it is also important to say the following. Rarely with wastewater discharges do you have evidence like we have here. Usually things are inconclusive and they're measured in parts per billion. I'm not aware of any circumstance in which an entity like yourselves, a regulatory agency, is being asked or has ever been asked to discharge, to allow a 301H discharge into the geographic epicenter of a disease pattern. Whether or not it's right on top of the point, the discharge point, or a few miles away, that evidence is indisputable in the record. It is indisputable, and it matters not whether the otter population is going up a little bit or down a little bit. It's a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act. We'll talk a little bit about the end, about the selective information that we think you have gotten, with all due respect to your staff. But the presentation you've seen today is a great example of it. You have seen the narrow information that best supports in the view of staff and the discharger, and they're one and the same here in terms of their alliance, best supports their perspective. And that's really unfortunate, because what you need to make a decision is what the law requires that be presented to you in a quasi-adjudicative setting like this one, where you're acting as judges, is at least a neutral presentation of the pros and cons, and you haven't gotten that. And that's regrettable. We're going to try to even the score a little bit. Before we start our presentation, I'd just like to leave you with one other thought, because you might be thinking it. Is this a situation where the environmental groups just won't take yes for an answer? Is this a situation where we sort of solve this problem, and why are we still here with all the problems that we all have to deal with? Well, we're sensitive to that. We have very limited resources, the two of us, working on this and all sorts of other things throughout California and the West. And we wouldn't be here today if this problem had been solved, if 8.5 years, which is approximately what the upgrade schedule is, was okay. And the reason it's not is because this discharge is into an epicenter of disease. And in that circumstance, we ask you and the law asks you to give the doubt to the public health and the environment, not to the discharger. If there's any doubt in this circumstance, it should go to protection of the environment and not toward using a 301H waiver as a bureaucratic tool to allow this discharger to upgrade in a way that it has desired to do. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Anjali to start the presentation.
Good afternoon, members of the board, Director Strauss. I'm Anjali J. Swall with NRDC. Well, today we're here to ask you to do the right thing. I'm going to ask David, next slide, please. And we have 3 points. And here they are. Our first point is to deny the 301H waiver, not just because that's a legal requirement, but because that's the right thing to do for the community, and that's what the evidence shows. We are also urging you to require the plant to upgrade the plant as fast as possible. And this last point, David will cover it. It talks about the arbitrary and unlawful administrative process that has resulted to NRDC and other community groups involved in this process. So moving to the first point, deny the waiver. This has, next slide, click. Okay. This has 2 points in it. The first point, which I'm going to spend some time on, and you've heard some discussion, is that the plant has not satisfied the balanced indigenous population requirement. That is the plant's burden here. The second point, the plant cannot meet its burden of demonstrating compliance with water quality standards. Again, this is the plant's burden. Next slide. So, as you know, we submitted our comments in this report, and we discussed all the legal requirements. I'm not going to go through all of them, but I wanted to highlight what they are, the critical, important ones. These are legal requirements, federal requirements. Here's a provision from the Clean Water Act, and it says that the discharge of pollutants in accordance with such modified requirements will not interfere alone or in combination with pollutants from other sources with the attainment or maintenance of that water quality which assures the protection of the protection and propagation of a balanced indigenous population of shellfish, fish, and wildlife. Put simply, the federal regulations ask a balanced population of shellfish, fish, and wildlife must exist. This is how it's put in the federal regulations. It states it plainly. Next slide. So what does that mean? Well, here's what EPA guidance tells us it means. EPA guidance says, in assessing whether a balanced indigenous population exists, whether there's a potential impact, here are four critical considerations, the four main objectives. Well, as we've highlighted, one of the key objectives is communities of threatened and endangered species. Next slide. Well, this has been analyzed in decisions before. Here's from the Environmental Appeals Board, which functions as an appellate court for the EPA. And they have determined that both individual and community considerations are relevant. Now, why is this important? This is important because just an analysis of benthic communities that you've heard from the plant is not sufficient to meet their burden that they are not, that they are not impacting an individual species, such as the sea otters. The Environmental Appeals Board goes on to say that we are not prepared to assume that because one community apparently has not been affected, protection of other communities has been demonstrated. So all the statistical gymnastics that you've seen from the plant and all of its graphing still does not squarely address their burden here. Again, the State Water Board defines it similarly. Degradation of biological population and communities considers diminished numbers of species or individual of single species, such as a sea otter. There's one more click. So what is all this, in considering the threatened species, these are other considerations, and this is directly from the EPA guidance on how this is supposed to be properly done and properly assessed. It says you're supposed to consider abundance. You're supposed to consider growth and reproduction of populations, disease frequency, presence or absence of indicator species, indicator, sentinels, keystones that say how the ecosystem is doing. Next slide, please. So there's no debate here. The California sea otter is a threatened species. It's been listed as a threatened species since 1972, and it is struggling for recovery. Click. Its current population is 2,500 to 2,700. Click. And so what this evidence right here, the existence of this threatened species alone, is record evidence that the otter population is not balanced. Evidence that the plant has not met its burden. Okay, click. So this is an interesting point in right here what you see. Let me just set it up for you. This is a letter that the plant submitted through its consultant, marine research specialist. You have it in your packets. I'm sure you've reviewed it. What they say is the otter cannot possibly come into contact with T. gondii. That means T. gondii from its plant near the outfall. Well, here's what they say in their 2005 report. They say, well, actually, we saw an otter right at the diffuser structure. And in their 2005 report, they go on to say that this statement supports that the otter's presence and the attest to the, I'm not reading that right, but basically that there is an otter population there. Well, they can't have it both ways. They can't say there's no way the otter comes into contact with T. gondii from our facility or from our diffuser and say, oh, and we've seen otters right on top of our diffuser. Again, they go on with this and they say, you know, actually, they even in all of this evidence, and I'm covering five categories of evidence here. This is the first category where they say that a healthy, balanced indigenous population exists. Well, in addition to the threatened species, these are the stranding rates that we've seen. And Cayucas, Morro Bay area, for consecutive years has had the highest stranding rates for the California sea otter. anywhere.
Could you tell me what a stranding rate is?
A stranding rate is when they find the sea otters and they are either struggling for recovery or they're dead, or they find them and they soon die thereafter. And this is the basis on which the necropsies are conducted by, and specifically the scientists at UC Davis and that research team. Please ask me any clarification questions. Okay, next slide. Okay, well, this should answer the question some more. Steve Shimmick from the Otter Project, he's the executive director, and who's here today will probably discuss this more, submitted a letter into the record in response to the marine research specialist consultant letter that the plant submitted. And he actually said, the spring surveys for 2005 found that the otter population is down. Next click. There's a couple things in here, so I want to move quickly because of time. They're finding higher and higher percentage of the population dead on the beach. And they're attributing this to disease. I'm going to get into that more, so I'm just going to go to the next slide. The disease epicenter. Now, you saw this map that is not a map that we created. In fact, most of this evidence, all of this evidence, is not evidence that we have created, NRDC has created. It's been from articles, from hard facts. Here's one of them. This is from an article from Patricia Conrad, one of the leading otter scientists. And you've seen this map, so I don't need to detail it too much, but I want to highlight. It shows that Morro Bay, Estero Bay, is a hot spot for T. gondii-infected otters. The California otters living in the area of Morro Bay are 9 times more likely to have T. gondii than sea otters elsewhere in their range. I don't need to explain T. gondii, do I? We've been talking about that? Okay. Here's another article, too, and this one is from Dr. Melissa Miller, another leading scientist whose name you must have heard and read about in the papers amongst the parties and staff. And she says, notably, interestingly, this is the only region within the southern sea otter range where primary treated municipal sewage is permitted to be discharged into the nearshore marine environment. Again, this is a graph from the UC Davis team. And I know it's hard to read because of all the colors and everything, but if you look at it, and what they actually say on their website is they say that nearly 50% of the otter deaths are due to disease. And then also in the recovery plan, it says, while sea otter mortality has a variety of causes, we know, we've heard, you know, stormwater or other sources or feral cats, but it said that the single most important known cause of mortality among the southern sea otter is infectious disease caused by land-based sources. So these variety of causes is coming from land-based sources of pollution, including the plant. That is part of the plant's burden to show that its discharge is not impacting the otter and that a balanced indigenous population exists.
Let me just interrupt 1 second on that, if it's okay with you. I stopped the clock. If they've tested their effluent and they can't show that there's any toxoplasma in the 120 mussels, what else can they do to meet that burden?
Well, I'm glad that you've asked that question. The testing that they've done is inconclusive.
It's state of the art.
The testing, as I will get to, maybe I should just advance to that slide.
I didn't want to interrupt you,
okay,
but that was...
I'm going to address that, and we can... If you want me to address it now, I'll advance.
No. You can address it when you want to, but that's...
Okay. I certainly will. Thank you for the question. So here's what T. gondii actually does to the sea otters. It causes encephalitis, brain disease, which is like brain disease spasms. And I know this is a disgusting picture, so I'll just move quickly. But the T. gondii infection, the brain disease, interacts with other harmful effects to the otters, like shark attacks and heart failure. Next slide. Okay. This is another letter discussing the disease epicenter. This is from Dr. Mazet, who's the director of the UC Davis research team. And she's saying that specifically we found spatial clusters of mortality due to T. gondii encephalitis in Estero Bay. There's a cluster happening right here in Estero Bay. And she says this clustering suggests that there may be local factors enhancing T. gondii exposure or increasing sea otter susceptibility in this particular area. Local factors. Next slide, please. Oh, sorry. And she goes on. So it's not just us saying that the otters are struggling their recovery and they have recovery challenges. Dr. Mazet says it here, saying that the otters are likely to continue to face significant recovery challenges. Okay, in addition to being a threatened species and the high strandings and the disease epicenter, you asked what the evidence is. Well, the evidence shows harm to the otters. We have listed nearly 20 studies done just since the plant submitted its application, or right when the plant submitted its application. The plant and staff, with all due respect, doesn't even grapple with this evidence and what it means. This is hard evidence showing that the plant hasn't satisfied its burden, showing that there may be a potential impact. Next slide. This is another key feature that we haven't heard a lot about today. But not only is a sea otter an icon that drives tourists here, that drives the economy, it represents the overall health of the ecosystem in two ways. This is the first way. It's a sentinel species. This is an article by Dr. David Jessup, who also studies sea otters. And he has said, he says specifically, the unique biology of the sea otter makes them an excellent sentinel species, one that can tell us a lot about pollution problems and ecological change. He's saying what happens to the sea otter is going to happen to the rest of the ecosystem. And his conclusion in this is that overall, what we see in the southern sea otters suggests there is a nearshore California marine ecosystem, that the nearshore California marine ecosystem may be sick. Next slide. Here's the other key role that the otter plays. This is an article from Dr. Patricia Conrad at UC Davis. And she says that the otter is a keystone species that controls the destruction of kelp forests by grazing urchins and thus helps maintain diversity of forest inhabitants and ecosystem services, including protection of the coastline from erosion. So it plays a multiple role, but the otter is what ties the ecosystem together. So not only what hurts the otter is happening to the whole system, but the whole ecosystem is dependent on the otter. Okay, now, this study is interesting. We submitted this into the record. It's a study by the lead author is Dr. Wotrina Miller. Dr. Miller, Wotrina Miller here, submitted this. We submitted this, and I know that the chair graciously accepted it into the record. But I wanted to note, too, this is the same study that staff relies on and submitted in your packet, got a letter from Marine Research Specialist is where this letter comes from. And the key conclusion in here is that one of the study findings was that mussels collected close to human sewage sources, sewage outfalls and septic tanks along the central coast were 39 times as likely to have any of the study bacteria compared to the mussels collected from locations distant to these sources. Well, I was going to say about it. That's okay. It's okay.
Was toxoplasmosis one of the?
No, that's a very good question. Toxoplasmosis was not one of the studies. One was not one of the bacteria here. However, the overall ecosystem and the pathogens that are infecting marine life and sea otter is what's being discussed here, and how the impact is from places where sewage plants are versus where places where sewage plants aren't. Okay, so you have all those five pieces of evidence that it's a threatened species, right? You have the high stranding rates. You have the disease epicenter. you have overall unhealthy ecosystem, and you have all these additional studies that have not been addressed. That's the evidence already showing the potential impact, and more importantly, showing that the plant has not satisfied the balanced indigenous population requirement. It hasn't met its burden. Okay, you have all that. Well, that's how the law is. There's another provision in the Clean Water Act, and this is an absolute prohibition. It says the prohibition is absolute. The prohibition shall apply without a causal relationship between such characteristics and the applicant's current proposed discharge. So to clarify, here's what the prohibition is. Where the discharge of any pollutant enters into a saline estuary, estuarine waters, which at the time of the application do not support a balanced indigenous population of shellfish, fish, and wildlife. So if it enters an estuary, like Morro Bay Estuary, a nationally recognized estuary, the first nationally recognized estuary, and there isn't a balanced indigenous population, which all the evidence is showing you, then it's clear. Absolute prohibition. There is no... In terms of enters, it's clear. It says, does it enter? Well, here's what we know about that. This is from the Marine Research Scientist letter again, and from the plant. And what they're saying is wastewater constituents do not enter Morro Bay Estuary in any ecologically meaningful amount. Implicit in that statement is the admission that the discharge actually does enter the estuary. And the only dye study that we have that's been conducted, the only monitoring on the fate and transport of this plant that's needed here, it was done over 20 years ago, and it showed actually that the discharge is entering the estuary.
I have a question.
Okay.
This is sort of interesting to me because how much is too much, or is there some level where a little bit's okay?
No, a little bit is not okay.
So, like, if one molecule drifts down and goes in, that's not okay?
This is not me.
I'm just trying to figure out what we're talking about here.
That's right. And to answer your question directly, The Clean Water Act says enters. Because it's the protection that estuaries deserve. Congress has determined estuaries are so meaningful to ecosystems, we want to protect them. And over 30 years ago, when they were giving these waivers for waivers to meeting basic Clean Water Act standards, they said, well, you know what? We know you ocean dischargers are saying you want this waiver. That's what the legislative history shows. Mm-hmm. And then they say, but estuaries. We know estuaries are important. I don't need to explain to this board that protects water quality why estuaries are important.
No, we know that.
Well, okay, go ahead.
But Mr. Shallcross's point, you know, it's a good point, and I've been thinking about that myself. Where's the line? And he did use the extreme example as to, is one molecule that comes out of a discharge, which theoretically could happen for almost any of these plants up and down the coast, that gets into Morro Bay, is that problematic?
Well, that's not what we're talking about here.
But
and I'll explain. The amounts that you're talking about are not the amounts in the study. In fact, there have been several studies, and Mr. Briggs can probably explain how these work better than I can, and have been studied intensely in this area, how the estuary actually functions as a Coke bottle, and the water comes into the estuary and goes out of the estuary. There's heavy mixing, so it's not just small, minuscule, insignificant transfer that's going on between the two water bodies.
May I just add one thing to this? And I think this goes really to the questions generally that you have to grapple with, which is when you're sitting as a court, what's the role of your own policy sense in interpreting your obligation here today? And the simple answer to the question is that the law tells you what's reasonable, whether or not you think maybe the law should have said something different. Maybe in your view, and I don't know if this is your view, Mr. Shallcross or Chair Young, maybe it should have said in ecologically meaningful amounts, which is how the consultant for the plant modified it. But that's not what this says. The pollutant enters is the phrase. It's very simple and very straightforward.
I know. I'm just trying to get a grasp on what that means. Because, I mean, obviously, if the discharge is to the estuary, that's out.
Right.
Now it's, you know, down, you know,
a block away from the mouth of the estuary, obviously there's going to be an impact, but how far away does the...
Right.
At some point, you have to say, it's so insignificant, it doesn't matter. And I'm just trying to see if you have any idea or can help me figure out where that line is.
Yeah, well, thanks, David, for that clarification. The law is clear that it's entered. And to answer your question in terms of the line, there's a heavy mixing rate going on between Morro Bay and Estero Bay. So in terms of the impact, it's significant. It's a significant amount of mixing.
Okay, and do you have, like, you were mentioning some dye?
We have submitted that into the record.
Do you have a picture of it to show plume entering the...
I don't think that it has a picture. We were looking for this, and even though it's not our burden, we were looking for it, and...
No, it's not your burden, but it might
be... No, I'm sure.
It might be helpful to your case if you could show evidence to the contrary.
Right. Yeah. And we have that study. We've submitted into the record. It's a 20-year-old study, and we don't have a slide of it.
Okay, thanks.
I just need to say one thing about the term enters into the saline estuary. The statute actually says any discharge into a saline estuary.
It doesn't have the word enters?
No, it doesn't.
Mr. Beckman, is that true?
That is true. Ms. Okun, I believe you have the Code of Federal Regulations right at your desk.
I'm looking at the statute, but...
Well, you know, I would like to make a point of order here. I would appreciate if Ms. Okun has, if she wants to make an opposition brief or an opposition argument, I think it would be appropriate that she allow us to finish. If there's some clarification about any of the information, we'd be happy to provide it. But engaging in a to and a fro with staff counsel is precisely the type of bias that we have complained about throughout this entire process.
Mr. Beckman, I find it very appropriate for the board's attorney to let us know if there's being any misstatement of what the law is.
Well, sir... Okay,
and that's what I would like to know right now.
Well, sir, you are the chair, so you can run the hearing any way you want. But I object for the record to the long history of arbitrary and unfair treatment of critics of the proposed action, which has started at the beginning of this year, is well documented by us, and continues here. Ms. Okun could well have critiqued the presentations that went before, which were selective, incomplete, and also subject to the same type of micromanagement that Ms. Okun's doing here, but she didn't. And I think the board needs to understand, and we will get to this later, that aside from the four corners of the merits between you, that the actions of the board and its staff in dealing with people who don't agree with the board have been regrettable. And in my experience of 11 years at NRDC and 15 practicing law in California, I have never before seen anything remotely like it.
Well, Mr. Beckman, you're entitled to your opinion. Your objection is noted, and I want to get an answer to my question as to what this section does state. So you can put
Chairman
in...
I've made my objection, Your Honor.
Fine.
Chairman Young.
Yes.
Ms. Okun is reading from the statute. This is from the federal regulations, which explain what the statute means and what the statute says. It's at 40 CFR 125.59B4.
Why don't we take a second so Ms. Okun can confirm this?
Hang on one second, please.
Exactly.
Excuse me. Director Strauss, since these are federal laws, do you have any input into what is being debated here? No? Okay.
That is what the regulation says. It's not what the statute says.
What's the quote? What are we citing, Ms. Okun?
Mr. Beckman, please.
My objection has been, I assume, overruled.
Is this what the regulation says?
Yes.
Okay. And what were you referring to, the statute?
Yes.
And what does the statute say?
No permit issued under this subsection shall authorize the discharge of any pollutant into saline estuarine waters which at the time of application do not support a balanced indigenous population of shellfish, fish, and wildlife. And then it goes on to talk about recreation.
Director Strauss.
I don't know if it would be helpful, but I think that the threshold point here is whether or not a balanced indigenous population exists. And there are different views on the subject. If a balanced indigenous population exists, you go down one path. If it's found that a balanced indigenous population does not exist, then you are put in these various circumstances. Historically, that has been very rare, but it still is very clear that if you find that you don't have a balanced indigenous population, then the statute and regulations take you down this path. So the threshold question and the point that Ms. Jaiswal is focusing on is whether or not a balanced indigenous population exists. And I would suggest that we could continue to go through this and just bear that in mind. It's more, does BIP exist? And if so, one thing, and if not, then the prohibition, et cetera.
Okay, well,
if that's helpful.
That I appreciate. What I was trying to, we were trying to grapple with, and it was Board Member Shallcross's question as to what are we looking at when we talk about discharge into saline waters. Does that mean directly saline estuarine waters? Does that mean outside the bay is okay?
The circumstance where EPA faced this in Los Angeles was a discharge into federal waters. And in this situation, a discharge into the bay, I mean, I think we'd have to be fairly clear about where we were talking about a discharge into state waters versus a discharge into federal waters, if that's helpful.
Well, how about just forgetting about whether they're federal or state waters, but whether they are saline and or estuarine waters? Forgetting about the label of state or federal. If these were all federal waters, how would you interpret it in terms of this discharge occurring in its present location?
In its...
up the coast, some distance from the mouth of Morro Bay.
I mean, it triggers an EPA permit for a number of reasons, but I would first have to cross the threshold of whether or not a balanced indigenous population exists. And I know you understand that.
Okay.
To me, saline versus estuarine is covered when you get to the absolute prohibition.
And because EPA has determined that a balanced indigenous population is being maintained, you didn't get to the next question, the next part of the analysis.
That is what is in our proposed tentative decision and proposed permit.
Okay. All right. Okay. Let's continue.
Thank you.
Is the record clear that there was no inaccuracy in the citation?
The record is clear that that is a
Thank
correct and accurate quotation from
Thank
the regulation.
My job as a lawyer is on the line. You know,
yeah.
I attested that this was true in preparing this.
Okay.
But I'm just going to move on.
Okay.
Okay. Let's see. So with all this evidence, what does it show? You see the otter as a threatened species, struggling for recovery. You see the high stranding rate, the disease epicenter, the intensive legal study on this issue, the additional studies that have been done showing that a balanced indigenous population of otters does not exist in Estero Bay and Morro Bay. Despite that, EPA concludes, this is its conclusion, EPA concludes that a balanced indigenous population is being maintained in the vicinity of the outfall. EPA did a benthic analysis, a rote analysis that it does regularly, and hasn't squarely addressed all of this evidence on the sea otter, with all due respect to EPA. Well, the regional board also has a duty and an obligation to research this and to study this. And here's what the regional board staff report. This is the first staff report. And it has no conclusion on the balanced indigenous population requirement, no clear conclusion. Instead, the staff report excerpts this one statement from Dr. Patricia Conrad's study. You know, Chair Young, this is your question I'm about to get to about the study that was done. And the study is inconclusive. I understand that staff put up that quote from that letter, but staff ignored.
Can we have that quote back up?
Sure. Okay, so this is Patricia Conrad, and she's saying, we are unable to complete testing on the 120 mussels so it's not finished, that had been outplanted at Morro Bay outfall during that time. Toxoplasma RNA was not detected in any of the 120 mussels from the outfall buoy that have been tested thus far. So that's one excerpt from the letter. Here's the rest of the letter. If you would please allow me to show you the rest of the letter, and then I will take your questions. This is highly unusual. This is a highly unusual letter that Dr. Conrad wrote to the plant. And scientists don't usually put cover letters explaining their studies and saying, oh, wait, you know, here are the limitations. And it's not us saying it. This is Dr. Conrad saying it. That there may be, it is possible, that low concentrations of T. gondii could have been present in the shellfish, but they were not detected at these low levels, resulting in false negatives. This piece of evidence does not prove that the plant has a clean bill of health. There's nothing saying that the plant has a clean bill of health. And misquoting or just taking one piece and not representing what the lead scientist has said in an unusual letter does not ameliorate the plant's burden. Questions?
Well, I guess then the question was, what else could the plant do? I mean, what else could science do if they're using the state of the art at this point?
Well,
you're saying that, you know, they at this point can never meet that burden.
What I'm saying is what the law requires, as Director Strauss said, the key question here is, does a balanced indigenous population exist? The overwhelming evidence is no, it does not. And so,
and is that overwhelming evidence based on the fact that the testing could not detect any toxoplasma?
In part, there's inconclusive evidence because the plant can't show, hey, it's not us, because that's what they need to do to get this extraordinary 301H waiver. Mm-hmm. But there's the overwhelming evidence, the hard facts in the studies conducted by federal agencies, state agencies, universities,
what?
Saying that the sea otter population is not balanced.
Okay.
So the first key question is the otter population balanced? There's overwhelming evidence, and I've just shown you bits and pieces of the evidence. We've discussed it in detail in our report. You can read those 20 articles saying that the otter population is not balanced and that it's struggling for recovery.
Okay, just hypothetically, at what population level, if any, do you think the otter population has to reach?
That is not really the question before us. But, however, to answer your question, that is in the otter recovery plan, which I have read, but I'll defer that to Mr. Schimmick to answer when he gives his comments what the population is. But what we know is that the otter is a threatened species listed federally since the 70s and that it is struggling for recovery. That is the relevant question.
Okay.
Before you go on, I would just note that in the supplemental comments that we provided on page 14 and 15.
What's the date of the letter that you're looking at?
April 3rd, 2006. I'm sorry, it's April 3rd, 2006. We discuss and cite other ways of testing for T. gondii, Mr. Chairman. We do not agree, just based on the statements of the plant, that the method that they've chosen is the only way to test. And I think if you look at the evidence and the citations, you will see that there are other studies that claim that there are other methods to detect T. gondii.
That's in April
3rd, 2006, 14 and 15.
All right.
Chairman Young.
Yes, Mr. Hayashi.
I have a question. On a balanced indigenous population, Can you not have two balanced, two populations that are side by side to each other? So that maybe that you could have two populations that don't exactly mirror each other, one at the outfall and one closer to the shore and one farther out?
I'm not sure if I completely understand the question.
Okay, what by definition, a BIP? Give me your definition.
Sure. You know, David, could you just go back several slides to the law? Keep going. Several slides. I hope the counter is off. It's the, like one of the beginning slides. Okay.
So you, no, what I'm saying is, can you have a balanced indigenous population in a 50-yard area and have another balanced indigenous population in a 100-yard square area?
Right. It must assure a balanced indigenous population in the zone of initial discharge as well as outside the zone of initial discharge.
And they could be, they don't have to mirror each other.
A balanced indigenous population has to exist in both areas.
And a balanced, okay, but if you have shellfish and everything living in each zone and you have a different makeup living in the next population, you have two.
If I could just take a stab at that question.
I'm just, you know, thinking.
Sure, it's a good question. And we address it, I think, in the next slide. Because I think what you're asking, and tell me if this is along the right track, is if we have evidence that one population is healthy, but we have evidence that another population in the same area is not, how do we reconcile that? Is that the question?
Yeah, how do you reconcile that? Okay. It is not healthy if it's existing.
Right, and I think that the answer to the question is, and EPA had to look at this in order to answer the BIP question everywhere there are 301H waivers. And the basic answer is that in determining whether you have a balanced indigenous population, it's not enough just to show that one or more of the distinct populations in a particular region or in a particular zone are healthy. And this was actually, you are not the first to have to deal with this question. Some of the state case law from the State Water Board answered this. We are not prepared to assume that because one community apparently has not been affected, protection of the other communities has been demonstrated, which is to say that based on the evidence here on the otter problem, mortality and morbidity, the presence of healthy related populations like in faunal or benthic doesn't allow you to conclude that a BIP exists.
If you go back to the other one, the population of the otter is still on the rise, is it not?
Fits and starts.
Yeah, I'm not sure what slide
it depends on what range you're talking. Overall range, there has been a slight recovery, but the scientists, and I wish they were here today because they would tell you that, and as they've said in their letters, are facing serious recovery problems. The population is not in balance.
But they are gaining in numbers.
A slight increase. Again,
all right. that's all I
okay.
needed to know.
Well,
a slight increase statewide would, I think, be the answer. You're not focusing on statewide issues. The relevant consideration for you is not whether the graph tracks up statewide. It's what's happening within the area that you are considering issuing one of three dozen waivers in this whole country.
And the high stranding rates attest that. Okay, so we keep going.
One moment.
Sort of following up on your answer just now. So we're to focus on this area, a local area. I'm interested in the otter deaths and strandings in this local area.
Excellent. We have a slide on that.
Okay, good.
I must have been going too fast.
That's okay.
Let me slow down. Here,
is this the one?
No, I wasn't looking for that. What I'm looking for is a map that shows where these deaths and strandings are.
Well, here, David, could you please go back to that slide?
Is this telling us?
The one with the otter stranding, because that is there is a visual map there. I mean, a conceptual map. Forward.
I'm going to get fired.
Please. Okay, I'm going to answer your question in two ways.
Okay.
Oh, back. Okay, here we go. So here is, if you look at the locations, now you have to visualize a map of the Central Coast, which I'm sure you know very well. It starts out, so you can see where the areas are. You know, it has Moss Landing, and it goes down Cambria, And then it says, then it goes down and shows Cayucas and Hazard. This is direct data from the U.S. Geological Survey data. They didn't map it. I didn't create a map to show it. I just put, this is what their evidence is, and it shows the highest stranding rates in this area, in Estero Bay, for two consecutive years in a row. There's also the map from Patricia Conrad.
Right. But what I was mostly interested in the deaths, if you had a map that showed where, not the stranding, a stranding could be for any reason. It's not just toxoplasmosis. Where are the deaths of the otters?
Sure. Go ahead and
click. On the map of the ones that die of this disease.
Go ahead and click, David, please, because this is a quote from the slide. Click, please. Thanks. Okay. These are the hot spots, and these are the hot spots for T. gondii. As you can see, the highlighted, the high study rate. Morro Bay is the highest for T. gondii, and it said that they are 9 times more likely to have toxoplasmosis than sea otters elsewhere in their range. There's been intensive study about this in several of the articles that shows that Morro Bay is a hot spot for T. gondii specifically.
Okay, but, I guess, I mean, this is along, you're talking about the red zone there? From San Simeon down to Morro Bay?
No, I'm talking about the star.
The star, and the star is in Morro Bay?
Yes, it is. In fact, it's the center of that range is directly, it's just a few yards from the discharge point. If I had that map that Matt Thompson had and that Carollo had that they both used, and we put the star, it's like right at the mouth of the, right before the mouth of the Morro Bay estuary, okay. And then the plant diffuser is right here.
Yeah, okay. Thanks.
Okay.
That's helpful.
Okay. That would seem to contradict what the discharger told us, that those numbers were spread over that 12-mile red zone. So that in my mind right now, that's in dispute.
That may
be. And I'd like to see the data so I can, in my mind, get that resolved.
Okay, it's in the record. And it's a range.
Well, okay, if you could go back, I think your table had, was it Morro Bay to Hazards Canyon or something?
That's the geological surveys data, not ours.
But didn't that pinpoint the hot spot also? Is that one of the same?
That pinpointed high as...
high prevalence?
As Mr. Shallcross astutely pointed out, that was high stranding. And he wanted to know about T. gondii in particular, and that's addressed in the studies and in the map. And yes, it's the range where the outfall is. The outfall is right in the heart of that range, and it's where it disperses throughout the ocean in Estero Bay.
Okay. I'm going to push the clock again, so it's been off for while we've been enjoying this discussion.
Okay.
We can continue. Okay, go ahead.
Oh, no. Okay. So I've explained how that study is inconclusive. And what we wanted to see, what we wanted to know is what kind of study did staff actually do here? Staff received lots of information from us, and with an extended deadline for the plan only, more evidence was submitted. And we wanted to see what's their discussion, how did they grapple with these 5 categories of evidence showing imbalance? Well, we requested it from staff in a Public Records Act request. And this is a response letter. This is a second response letter saying that the withheld documents are all subject to attorney-client privilege and work product. They submitted an email that we'll get to later. But what this says is that where are the biologists? Where are the regional board's biologists on this? How are they looking at this, at the marine ecosystem? Where is that evidence? Is an attorney the only person or critically involved in all of these discussions to determine that a balanced indigenous population exists to answer this scientific question and to recommend it to you, the board? The evidence doesn't support staff's conclusion. So here's my conclusion slide. And I know that we've seen a scale before. And here's a scale. You know, you have to weigh the evidence here. And you have to weigh the evidence in light of the burden, of course. Well, what do you have on one side? On the plant side, you have unsupported assertions based on inconclusive studies, on a single inconclusive study, Pat Conrad's study. You have, as part of that, you have this statistical gymnastics going on. And just to capture it without going into it, you know, we all know that famous quote, there are lies, damn lies, and then there's statistics. Well, you've seen this statistical gymnastics going on by the plant today. On the other side, you have hard evidence. Not evidence that we made up, hard evidence by federal agencies, state agencies, scientists, showing that the otter is a threatened species, showing high stranding rates, consecutive years, showing a disease epicenter, intensive scientific research on this issue because the otter is struggling for recovery, because the population is not in balance. You have the overall unhealthy ecosystem. And you finally have the estuary prohibition, and you can do with that as you wish, but that is just one of the many pieces of evidence. The plant hasn't met its burden to show that a balanced indigenous population exists. And that's how it plays out. The 301H waiver must be denied. So I'm moving on to my second subpoint for the 301H waiver.
One second.